For the last 3 months, there have been 246 Tamil asylum seekers with 30 children on board a boat in Merak, Indonesia. They are presently being denied asylum in Australia, their original destination. Over 100 of the people on board already have refugee documentation from the UNHCR, and 24 are in the final stages of refugee documentation, and the rest are waiting for the UNHCR process. They are suffering from ill health and are without access to medical supplies and the basic amenities. One man has already died from lack of adequate medical attention. Jessica Chandrasekar recently returned from Indonesia, where she is working towards reaching an agreement in the situation and supporting the asylum seekers with the process. Jessica is an organizer with the Canadian Humanitarian Appeal for Relief of Tamils, a Canadian organization that has as its mission to highlight the humanitarian crisis and human rights violations in Sri Lanka to the world and specifically to all levels of Canadian society. Hello, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. So I would like to start off by just asking you, what is the current situation with the asylum seekers on the boat in Indonesia?
Well, the current situation, the conditions continue to deteriorate. The people on the boat continue to be denied medical care, safety, access to UNHCR, proper food. There's one woman who's pregnant. Her name is Manju, and her due date is March 5th. So everybody's, you know, quite concerned about what's going to happen when she finally goes into labor, what kind of safety she'll be guaranteed, and what kind of medical assistance she'd be provided, if any at all. And we actually recently found out that her baby is not facing the proper birthing position, so people are very concerned and very scared.
And you went to Indonesia to I guess consult and work with these asylum seekers, representing HART, the Humanitarian Appeal for Relief of Tamils. So what was the objective of your visit? What did HART want to get out of this visit?
Well, at the beginning of January, we found out about how 9 of the asylum seekers, the Indonesian government had given the Sri Lankan government access to these 9 asylum seekers, and they were being interrogated by Sri Lankan officials. And then we also got word that all of the asylum seekers were being threatened with deportation. So we were quite concerned about this. So we thought it would be important to send somebody there to advocate on their behalf. So we had, some major demands that we kind of wanted to discuss with the Indonesian authorities, which, were no deportation back to Sri Lanka, where the people would undoubtedly be persecuted, to cease the interrogations by the Sri Lankan officials and provide the people access to UNHCR, which they continue to be denied, and to give them proper humanitarian aid.
And just within this situation, for me, I know when I first heard of it, it was a bit difficult for me to understand that they left Sri Lanka and were on their way to Australia, but were intervened by the Indonesian officials. So there's a kind of collusion going on here. So can you talk about that a bit more?
Well, as is well known, Australia is a white supremacist state and, are very against having refugees coming in. And as we all know, refugees come from post colonies, which are of racialized people, and they don't want this influx of people to come, or what they consider to be an influx of people. So what the Prime Minister of Australia did when he found out about the boat, when the boat was leaving Malaysia, was he called the Indonesian president and asked him to intercept the boat once it entered Indonesian waters. The Indonesian authorities did this under the pretense that Australia would eventually find a place to take the refugees. They didn't realize that Australia would completely wash their hands of it. And now we have all of these people, all of these asylum seekers who are fleeing persecution in limbo, and they've been completely stranded.
And you were there for a few weeks, I think. Can you tell us a bit about what the current, like, in terms of I mean, whatever you think is important that the Canadian public know about these people, and where is the process now? Where is it standing, and what are the prospects look like?
Well, I mean, I had an opportunity to meet several of the asylum seekers, of the Tamil asylum seekers, and I'm in daily contact with them as well. When I went there, I was just completely floored at the kinds of conditions that these people are living in. They fled Sri Lanka because they're fleeing a genocide, they're fleeing internment camps and persecution, and now 31 children are on this boat who are suffering and slowly dying. The youngest child celebrated her first birthday on the boat, was actually learned how to walk on the boat, and what had happened was this child was born in a bunker in Sri Lanka amidst bombing and fighting, and her mother managed to, you know, give birth under these conditions, grab her child and flee, and now this is what they're living in.
And I had mentioned at the beginning that there are 24, no, or maybe I don't even know, you can tell me how many, that already have their documentation from the UNHCR, and 100 more are already on their way to getting their documentation. So the intervention by the Indonesian authorities in blocking legitimate, you know, in quotes, in refugees, in quotes as well, like, what are the implications of that? That's really serious.
Yeah, well, Indonesia is not a signatory to the UNHCR convention, so they're not obligated under, you know, to treat asylum seekers or refugees under international conventions. So what ends up happening is the people are actually treated as non-humans. They're treated even worse than animals. So while some people do, I think it's 109 who do have UNHCR documentation, it's documentation from Malaysia, so that's where the boat left from, and it's not recognized in Indonesia. So if they were to be processed in Indonesia, then they could, it would be recognized, but the UNHCR is being blocked, and because Indonesia is not a signatory to UNHCR, they're not obligated to allow UNHCR to process these people. And the implications of that is that their refugee status is not legitimized, and their families can't sponsor them, so they can't start the settlement process, so they're essentially being trapped.
And I mean, that speaks to a lot, right? That the Australian government, which I'm assuming is a signatory to the UNHCR, would call Indonesia to block this boat. Like, that's not a coincidence.
No, it's not a coincidence at all. They're definitely working together, but then there's also some tense relationship, too. Neither wants to take responsibility for the people either. So it's this kind of geopolitical arrogance that's kind of displaying itself in the most inhumane form.
And I think this, tell me if I'm stretching this too far, kind of speaks to the imperialist project, where white settler societies like Australia, like Canada, are manipulate other third world countries to do their dirty work. We can see the Cold War was not a cold war in hot zones like Asia and Africa. Mm-hmm. And this seems to be like a perpetual kind of repetition of that imperial power.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And not only is it a display of imperialism in Australia's sense, but it's also how particular governments become invested in this kind of white supremacist imperialist project as well. So, it's really quite interesting because the local people, the Indonesians, there's such high rates of poverty. And the discourse that the government draws on to legitimize their treatment of the refugees is that, our people are poor anyways, we don't want to deal with this problem. But the people themselves, the poorest people who I met when we were going to see the boat are actually quite supportive of the people on the boat. The food that they're provided by the IOM contains maggots and dirt and nails and all sorts of awful things, so they can't actually eat it, but the local people will bring them food.
So you were able to see that. Can you talk a bit more about that kind of solidarity, I guess, that's between the Indonesian people and these Tamil refugees on the boat?
Well, It's very interesting because when we went there, we met with a network, an advocacy network, and a part of the advocacy network is the Socialist Party of Indonesia, who started this network for asylum seekers and refugees. And so what they're trying to do is to help refugees by building solidarity and making these connections between the poverties that for example, farmers or workers in Indonesia experience, and then refugees and how the issues that impoverished Indonesians are facing are also what precipitates this all the asylum seekers and refugees that are around the world as well. So they're making these kinds of connections.
And I want us to talk about kind of like the more wider context of the Tamil genocide in Sri Lanka, and also even more of like the global context of refugees and north-south migration. But before we get to that, I'm wondering now, where is the process? And kind of just trying to strategically understand it in my head. So this boat is it being like physically trapped by Indonesian officials to keep their journey going to Australia? And clearly they don't want to get off the boat because land in Indonesia, they'll likely be denied this refugee status that they're looking for. So like, what is kind of, I guess, the physicalities of this? And then where are solidarity groups planning to take this struggle?
Well, the boat is physically tied to the port, so it's being kept in that sense. But the Indonesian government keeps on saying, oh, people can get off the boat at any time. We're not forcing them to stay off the boat or stay on the boat. But what happens when people leave the boat is that they're brutalized by the Indonesian police. They're put into detention centers, and they're harassed, and then they're threatened with deportation. So in a sense, they are also, their mobility is very limited, and they cannot leave the boat. So in one sense, they're being told that they can leave the boat, and this is what the Indonesian government is publicly saying: oh, these asylum seekers refuse to leave the boat, and this and that. But in reality, several people have tried and were put into a detention center. And actually, 2 weeks ago, the IOM came to bring medicine, but they weren't allowed on the boat. So 4 people got off the boat to get the medicine because the people on the boat are so sick. And once these 4 people got off the boat to pick up the medicine, they were brutally beaten by the police. And I haven't gotten word yet as to whether or not they're actually still able to get the medicine and bring it onto the boat.
And where like, it's a bit of a stalemate right now, right? Mm-hmm. But what are the possible options to where to go from here?
Well, right now we're working with groups who are in Australia, New Zealand, and Indonesian groups on the ground. And what we're trying to do is, on the Canadian side, is we're trying to, we have a list of requests of the Indonesian government that has been endorsed by several Canadian unions and organizations that we're going to be submitting to the Indonesian authorities here. We're also trying to see if the Canadian government can bring the people here and to accept them. In Australia, they're trying to pressure their government and hold their government accountable for what has happened for Jacob's death. And similarly with the New Zealand group, they're also trying to work with their government and see what they can do on their end. And with the groups in Indonesia, the people on the boat, because the boat has become such a sore spot and a site of tension, the Indonesian government is going to be forcing the people off the boat. They're going to be storming them, and the process is going to be very violent, and they're going to be forcing the people into a small warehouse in East Jakarta. So that will be happening within the next couple weeks, and the groups on the ground are trying to mobilize around this so that they can make this process as less violent as possible, so that there's media attention and so that the world knows.
And I want, if you could contextualize this particular situation within the wider context of the Tamil struggle in Sri Lanka and all over the world, and how is this fitting into that that discourse of genocide in, in Sri Lanka?
Well, a lot of people just kind of understood the situation in Sri Lanka as a civil war, but it's not a civil war at all. It's a genocide. So while the war might technically be over, the genocide is continuing, and there's people who are in internment camps. There's, as you mentioned, you know, journalists who are being disappeared. There was a 9-year-old girl a couple days ago who was raped by the Sri Lankan authorities, and when her mother tried to protest this, she was killed. Over 100 women were just from the IDP camps were recently put into a prison and are being tortured. So this proliferation of asylum seekers that we're seeing right now is because of these conditions, and because actually after the war, the conditions for the Tamil people are only worsening.
And also, I'm wondering if you can contextualize it within a global migration. There's a global migration of, you know, the quote-unquote good immigrants who come to Canada, for example, on the point system. And then there's like this increasing flow of refugees, you know, kind of traveling all around the world. So if you could contextualize that more in, I guess, a global movement of people.
Well, with refugees, often they're stateless people or people who are not recognized within a nation state. And as we all know, the modern nation state is based, is very, it's racialized and it's gendered. So if you're not racialized, or if you are racialized and gendered in a particular way, you are a stateless person, and you are not a citizen of that nation state. And so what we're seeing is just this continued violence of this kind of imperial nation states, and a proliferation of refugees around the world. And what's quite interesting is that these stateless people are recognized as stateless or nationless or as non-human in the countries that they also flee to. So we can see that with the way in which Australia is understanding these refugees, or how the Canadian government recognizes, you know, particular people. So the good, educated immigrant who's, you know, only going to support white supremacy will be recognized, you know, within a particular kind of citizenship. It's never full citizenship, but a refugee, particularly a person of color, a refugee who's fighting for self-determination, through nationalism, it will never be recognized as human within the modern nation state or within white supremacist nation states.
And speaking of Canada, you are part of an organization called Canadian Heart, which is the Canadian Humanitarian Appeal for Relief of Tamils. And this is a Canadian organization. Canada has a very large Tamil refugee population. So can you speak to the support internationally that the Tamil people in various countries, Australia, I think you mentioned a bit here, and particularly here in Canada, have been lending to this particular case, but also to like a wider struggle of Tamils, both back in Sri Lanka, but also as refugees kind of trying to manipulate their moving around the world?
Well, the diaspora recognizes that that the people who are the Tamils who remain in Sri Lanka continue to suffer, and the Tamil diaspora recognizes that it's their obligation to help their brothers and sisters, and so the diaspora is quite organized, and we saw that last year as well. I mean, we didn't get what we wanted. We didn't, you know, have any kind of government or, you know, international intervention to stop the bombing of safety zones, or, you know, to force people to be released from internment camps. But the diaspora is very well organized and very concerned about the conditions of their brothers and sisters back home.
Okay, so we're coming just to the end of the time we have here, but I was hoping that you could give our listeners information where to contact Canadian Heart. Also, what can our listeners do to support this particular case, but also the wider struggle?
Well, With this particular case, because we're trying to push for the Canadian government to accept the people, something as simple as calling your MP and saying, you know, I heard about these asylum seekers who are in Indonesia. Can you, you know, work with Canadian Heart, or can you work with the Tamil community? Because MPs are very invested in getting reelected, so if people in their ridings call them and say this, they'll do it, not because they care, but because they want votes. To support the struggle or the Tamil people, the Tamil diaspora, internationally, it's you know, just very important to build solidarity, especially, you know, between oppressed groups, because as we're, you know, like the example of the Indonesian network who are kind of using this anti-imperialist framework to organize around refugee issues, we should start doing that in general. And I think that we're in a really good position to have these kinds of conversations. And then in terms of getting in touch with Canadian Heart, we don't have a phone number. Our email is news@canadianheart.org, and Heart is spelled H-A-R-T. And we also have a website, canadianheart.org, and Heart is H-A-R-T, not H-E-A-R-T.
So again, that's canadianheart.ca.
.org.
I'll say it again. CanadianHART.org. Jessica, I'd really like to thank you for coming in today. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we cut this interview off?
No. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much, Jessica. And that was Jessica Chandrasasesar, who is an organizer with the Canadian Humanitarian Appeal for Reliefs of Tamils. And she was recently in Indonesia working with the 246 Tamil asylum seekers who are trapped on a boat in Indonesia.